The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Catherine E. Zienoff presiding.
Good morning, counsel. This matter is case number 424-0690, Bruce Simulka, and I don't know if I've correctly pronounced the name, versus PS Energy LLC. Would counsel please identify yourselves for the record? Counsel for the appellant first.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Dan Nolan. I'm counsel for the appellant.
And good morning, Your Honor. My name is Margaret Rhodes. I am counsel for the appellee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nolan, you may begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As I just stated, my name is Dan Nolan. I represent the appellant in this matter, Bruce Smolucha. His last name has been mispronounced throughout the whole case, so that's quite all right. I understand that I am afforded 20 minutes here for the main argument pursuant to Rule 10, 110, with 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. As this honorable panel is well aware, we are here today regarding Smolucha's appeal on the trial court's order striking the Illinois Supreme Court Rule 191A affidavit of his industrial machinist expert, John Green, and the granting of summary judgment in favor of the defendant, PS Energy LLC. Unless there are specific questions from the panel, I will begin my argument, as there are a number of different issues to address here.
Counsel, good morning. I actually wanted to start with a question regarding the affidavit, Mr. Green's affidavit. How do you contend that this affidavit is based on the pertinent and correct facts? For example, while he did attend the inspection and observe the furnace, where was there any reference in this affidavit to data collected during the tunings or the combustion process, for example? I mean, there were references to the testimony of the employees who inspected and went to the plant, but where are there specifics in this affidavit?
Thank you, Your Honor. The affidavit lays out that Mr. Green is familiar with this type of machinery and during the inspection was able to evaluate and understand that this is the type of machinery he has been familiar with in the past. The issue in taking measurements at the actual inspection does not necessarily go to the issues of causation or duty and breach in this case. The inspection itself took place far after the January and February incidents in this case, where we do have evidence, specifically one day after the plaintiff's second poisoning, that there were elevated levels higher than the 500 ppm industry standard quantified by the defense of CO in the exhaust stacks. So the fact that Green in his affidavit didn't testify as to measurements taken at the inspection, I don't think necessarily goes to the issues in the case as to why he was retained. His affidavit more so lays out his familiarity with the machine and his familiarity with the standard of care applicable to industrial machinery experts, specifically in the combustion tuning field.
But counsel, these 191 affidavits have a little higher standard than if he were to testify as an expert during a trial. Isn't that correct? I mean, I think that's why we're focusing on this aspect of it.
Your Honor, I agree that the 191A affidavit is made in lieu of trial testimony in this specific instance. The issues with the court striking the affidavit based on his qualifications, and then on the other hand, based on what the court determined was speculative or misstating the evidence, I think are fleshed out in the briefs a little bit more, where it's plaintiff's position that the court took a leap here in disqualifying Mr. Green without the benefit of any cross-examination, any voir dire, an actual Frye motion, whereas his qualifications were laid out in the affidavit and the CV attached to the affidavit that does show he has 40 years of experience with this type of a specific type of annealing machinery. So his familiarity with that, dating back to the 1980s and the standard of care applicable to tuning these machines, is ultimately what should have qualified him to render opinions. And the 191A standard, which I believe is set out in the Bailey case, states that an expert may testify. Apologies, one moment. An expert may testify based on his personal knowledge, and self shall set forth, particularly with the facts upon which the claim is based, shall attach all documents and as to which he relies upon, and shall affirmatively show that if the affiant, if sworn as a witness, can competently testify thereto. And the trial court, in striking the affidavit in totality based on his qualifications, ignored the 40 plus years that Mr. Green had with experience with this types of machine. And two, furthermore, if the trial court were to have struck the portions of the affidavit that did not conform to 191A, specifically on speculation, the Bailey court also tells us that only the tainted portions of that affidavit should be stricken, and the remaining portion should be considered by the court, which was not done here.
But
So,
isn't that why
thank
we
you.
have a higher standard for 191 affidavits? Because the expert is not subject to cross-examination. You made mention about a Fry hearing, but that's why the affidavit has to be detailed and include everything and attach everything that they rely upon.
I would agree, Your Honor, and there hasn't been a position taken that certain documents were not attached to the affidavit. The affidavit, it was it, the defendant made the argument the affidavit should be stricken based on Mr. Green's qualifications, which the court agreed that he was unqualified, despite what I've already stated, his 40 plus years as an industrial machinery expert who's worked on these types of machines, and his familiarity with the standard of care applicable to combustion tuners who should be servicing these types of machines.
Counsel, I had another question, not specifically relating to this affidavit. We certainly can come back to that if we need to. But you agree, I believe, that PSN was on site for 2 days per year to perform maintenance, specialized services, I would say, specialized services on this furnace owned and operated by PTC. So, are you suggesting, by your arguments and what you've put in your brief, that PSN owed a duty to everyone who came into this plant, this Fairfield facility?
The argument set forth in the appellant's brief touches upon, first I'll back up. I would agree that PSN has made it evident that they should be on site every 6 months to tune these furnaces. And this goes to the specific argument in terms of the timeliness in addressing the call to address the CO issues. So yes, I would agree that PSN should be on site twice a year, but if they undertake that duty to come address the CO issues, and as laid out in the brief, take more than 3 weeks to arrive, which was also in excess of the every 6 months to treat this furnace, then the duty to have performed that in a timely manner was voluntarily undertaken, which with in accordance to the nonfeasance standard of the restatement under 324A would impart a duty onto those foreseeably who could be injured by the negligent undertaking of performing that timely combustion tuning.
What would the magnitude of that duty be then? Wouldn't that be too great for anyone to undertake in this in the context of this case, this business?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I would think the magnitude of the burden would be to ultimately do what they said they would do, which is if they received a call to come tune the furnace, they would do that in a timely fashion, and they would know that that should have been done within the 6 months, or alternatively, if there was CO issues as reported to PSN, that should have been done on an emergency basis due to the dangers posed by carbon monoxide, which the PSN employees had testified they were aware of.
Well, but now wasn't tuning different than repair of the furnace as a whole and looking into PTC's ventilation system? I think you're suggesting that they had voluntarily undertook a much broader job.
I would agree and disagree, Your Honor. I would say when PTC, the factory, called and said, "Hey, we need you to come address these CO issues," and PSN agreed to do that, they did expand their duty outside of tuning the furnace. But alternatively, when they were called to come and check out the CO issues, they did come to tune the furnace, and that's what they ultimately did. However, they came too late, where the plaintiff was poisoned before they came and tuned the furnaces and actually moved those tuners, those four tuners, down from above the 500 ppm industry standard back to acceptable levels. So that was done on the 27th, which was one day after the plaintiff's second poisoning, whereas it's plaintiff's position that should have been done sooner, or even better, in a timely fashion that would comport with the once every 6 months requirement that PSN had with these PTC factories.
I guess I had one other follow-up question. In this case, really, wasn't there undisputed testimony that this furnace system, would never produce unsafe levels of CO?
That, yes, Your Honor, and that was addressed in the brief, that is what I believe Mr. Wyant, the PSN employee, said, that even though there's some industry standard to keep these exhaust levels below 500 ppm, he stated that even if they are above 500 ppm, it's still somehow safe. It's plaintiff's contention that's pure ipsy dixit, and Mr. Green is qualified to testify as to those exceeding those standards is dangerous, and even that the 500 ppm standard is a self is a standard self-utilized by PSN. And the fact of the matter is that this industry standard, even if taken as true, of 500 ppm, was exceeded in four of these stacks by up to, I believe, even 18 times the amount, showing that if the tuning would have been done prior to the plaintiff's second poisoning, it's more likely true than not that the CO issues that the factories was experiencing would not have contributed to the plaintiff's inhalation of CO. And the work order of PSN even specifically states, that was authored by Mr. Stallard, that the high levels of exhaust from those four burners were, in his words, only slightly contributing to the CO issues in the plant. So there is an admission in the testimony and the work order that the four burners that were exhausting levels higher than 500 ppm were contributing to the CO issues in the plant.
Is there someplace in the record that we can find evidence that PSN actually did agree to correct PTC's CO problems? What can we look to?
I believe that was testified in the deposition of Mr. Stallard, where he testified that there was a call rendered by PTC, that there were CO issues in the plant, and that the combustion tuning had to be moved up for that emergency purpose. Let me see if I can pull up the
So you're just saying by voluntarily responding to that phone call.
By voluntarily responding to that phone call to address the CO issues relayed to PSN by PTC, they had a duty to do that in a timely fashion, especially because they labeled it as an emergency and knew the dangers of carbon monoxide. And even if you were to put all of this aside, they were due at the 6-month interval to tune this furnace in or about January 13th, which would have been 6 months after the last tuning in July, which
But tuning and repair and maintenance are two different things in this industry, isn't that correct? I mean, I'm certainly not an expert and learned from reading about this, but based on what I've read, they're not one and the same.
And that the trial court did latch on to that a little bit. I would agree with you that tuning and repairing aren't the same thing, but tuning and maintaining are words that can be interchangeable. Tuning is a process where, and I'm sure the panel is familiar with the briefs and the complicated ins and outs of how these furnaces work, where basically these burners in these furnaces degrade over time, and tuning comes in. Tuning's service team comes in to bring them back to proper ratios where they're going to be firing, so that they are not exhausting levels of over 500 ppm. It would be plaintiff's contention, and Mr. Green uses the word maintained in his affidavit, which the trial court latched onto, that tuning and maintaining are similar or one and the same, because it's they're both processes used to keep the tubing system at its status quo.
But
So I would
where
agree
do
with
we
the
have?
court that repair and tuning are not one and the same, but maintaining and tuning would be.
But where do we have any documentation of a contract between them that they agreed to repair these stacks? I mean, they have invoices that agree to the tuning,
Sure.
but where is the relationship that they agreed to come in and repair?
I Your Honor, I would agree that that's a more of a stretch. The maintaining issue and the tuning issue are more on point here than the repair issue, which the trial court and defendants did make note that there are differences there. But the maintenance of these burners and the tuning of these burners, it would be plaintiff's position, are one and the same, and were required of PSN to do those in a timely fashion.
So you're saying maintenance and tuning are the same thing?
That's what Mr. Green would say, and I believe the if we go to the letter of the definitions of the word, tuning and maintaining are the same or similar.
And he has factual support to support that opinion in his affidavit, that there's concrete evidence in this case that we can look at that there was an agreement that maintenance and tuning are the same, and that included what you're arguing, that they should have repaired the stacks if there was a CO leak.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if that's concretely laid out, but I obviously have reviewed his affidavit ad nauseum in the allegations in the complaint, and there are the utilization of the word maintained is common throughout the affidavit. And again, perhaps this could have been fleshed out more with cross-examination at some point, but that's not that was not the factual pattern in this case. I know there are a number of other issues, including duty breach, proximate cause, and my time is running short, obviously. I can give a quick bird's eye view as to one of those if the court has specific concerns on any of those three other arguments, or we can continue to address the 191A arguments, if there are further reservations.
Whatever you'd like, counsel.
I think I'll get through this quickly. I think the one of the important errors the appellant finds with the court's ruling is the conflation of duty and breach, where in the court's opinion, it has ultimately made a determination that there was no violation of the standard of care, based upon solely what Mr. Wyatt and Mr. Stallard testified to. The consideration of a duty versus a breach of duty is laid out, I think, very well in the Burger King case. I think it's Marshall v. Burger King, where the court determines, or the Supreme Court has explained to us that the existence of a duty and whether or not those duties were breached are two entirely separate considerations to be made, where the breach of the duties is for the trier of fact and weighing the evidence of, in this case, what would be Mr. Green versus the PSN employees is also for the trier of fact as well. And I see my time's up. If I can just give a quick conclusion, unless there's specific questions that would be better utilized in the time.
Go ahead and finish your sentence, counsel, and then you'll have time on rebuttal.
Okay. The conflation issue here, I think, is concerning because the trial court specifically noted in its order that a reason for granting summary judgment was that it found that there was no violation of the standard of care, which ultimately is a question of fact for the jury to be weighed for against plaintiff's witnesses versus defense witnesses. I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, but I thank you for the pointed questions to the panel.
Thank you. Ms. Rhodes?
Good morning, and may it please the court. We fortunately touched on a lot of what I would have wanted to talk about. Unless there are any specific questions at the onset, I do want to clarify some of the factual issues that were brought up by the appellant in terms of this industry standard. Appellant's understanding of the industry standard comes from himself as a layperson. Wyant, as an expert in combustion tuning, very clearly explained that that industry standard of 500 parts per million, his own personal standard of being 75 parts per million, relates to the conclusion of tuning. There's an understanding that the amount of carbon monoxide that's going to be exhausted will exceed that. That is normal, that is expected. The data that he looked at from the January 2018 tuning was, as he described it, a combustion system in good condition, especially given where it had been in the 4 years they had been working on it. So when plaintiff is using industry standard of 500 parts per million to conflate it with the maximum allowable exhaustion of carbon monoxide, that's simply not correct. That doesn't come from his expert. That comes from a layperson's misunderstanding. Additionally, this recommendation of 6 months of tuning and responding timely to an emergency tuning call, Your Honor Zinoff made the very pointed point that there's undisputed testimony that this furnace could have been allowed to be untuned indefinitely, and it would never produce amounts of carbon monoxide that would be hazardous to human health. That recommendation of 6 months, the recommendations that are made in the work service orders, all relate to efficiency. The purpose of combustion tuning is to maximize the heat that is used by the furnace without wasting gas. So, for example, with the industry standard of 500 parts per million, if at the end of tuning, you still have 500 parts per million of carbon monoxide being created, you're just wasting that gas. You have to go back and retune for efficiency's sake, not for safety's sake. I think that the timeline here is very important. PS Energy came out in July of 2017. They performed tuning. Plaintiff can offer no evidence that they did it inadequately. At some point in January of 2018, PS Energy was contacted in order to perform tuning in either the later part of January or the early part of February. They came out and they ended up tuning it on January 26th. At that point in time, plaintiff had had some vague symptoms in the week prior, but his first hospitalization, where there was actual medical record of elevated carbon monoxide, wasn't until the 27th. The day after PS Energy performed the tuning. After the tuning was performed, they took their final readings. There were 0 parts per million of carbon monoxide being exhausted from those 28 exhaust stacks. So, in short, in terms of causation, at that point in time, before plaintiff's first affirmative exposure to carbon monoxide, the combustion system could not have been a source. It was exhausting zero parts per million. Plaintiff ended up being exposed to elevated levels of carbon monoxide on the 27th of January, the 29th of January, and then February 16th. There is no evidence that the combustion system was producing carbon monoxide in any amount on any of those days.
So, counsel, if I could shift our focus for just a minute and go
Absolutely.
back to Mr. Green's affidavit, and some of the things we talked about, or I talked about with opposing counsel. If we look at Mr. Green's affidavit, there are many paragraphs, many references to testimony, and a lot of detail appears in this affidavit. So why weren't there, why can we say, or why can opposing counsel say that, I'm sorry, why do you say it wasn't based on facts? That was one of the questions I had. But if we really look at it carefully, what was wrong with this affidavit?
That is an excellent question. I have spent quite some time combing through this affidavit. I think at one point in time I had it memorized. In my motion to strike, I had an addendum that took it paragraph by paragraph with each allegation, each opinion, and then I compared it to the record. In most of these scenarios, I have it pulled up right now. For example, at one point he had an opinion that there was a crack that wasn't fixed. If you go back to the testimony related to that crack, it was all hypothetical. The witness started off by saying, well, we didn't know if there was a crack or not. The majority of the affidavit relies on the testimony of the two PS Energy technicians, Wyant and Stallard. If you go to each of the citations that are referenced, yes, those words exist in the testimony: excess carbon monoxide, running rich, high carbon monoxide. However, they provide a context that that just means there was carbon monoxide in the exhaust stacks. There was carbon monoxide at the end of this complicated chemical process. The affiant, Mr. Green, cherry picks those words and applies his own definition to them. He never explicitly says this machinery should never exhaust carbon monoxide, and therefore the fact that there was any carbon monoxide is a problem. He just takes their words at face value that there was more carbon monoxide than there should have been. But that's not the context. That's the main issue, I would say, with his affidavit. But it does take a careful reading of both the affidavit and the record to match up what he claims, and establish why it's either speculation, conjecture, or just a misstatement of the testimony.
Well, do you agree that the trial court here should have just stricken the parts that did not meet the requirements of 191A? I mean, isn't that what is usually done?
I would say that's a two-part question because if defendants had just moved to strike it on the basis of it being based in speculation, conjecture, or a misstatement of the evidence, then yes, I imagine the trial court should have taken a red pen and crossed out what was inappropriate. But the trial court also found that he was generally not qualified to render opinions about this system, combustion tuning as a whole, or what should have been done in this case, making it appropriate to strike the entirety of the affidavit. He's simply not an expert who can make any opinion about the subject matter he's talking about.
Well, the court did that without any voir dire, or, I mean, it was pretty arbitrary, was it not?
I would disagree generally. I think in any other situation, the ability to put forward your expert's opinions without subjecting it to cross-examination, criticism, or impeachment should have been a benefit. His opinions didn't have to undergo an analysis and should have been able to just be put forward. Unfortunately, in this particular situation, the facts simply don't support the plaintiff's position, and Mr. Green can't pull facts out of a magic hat and make them real. So I would say the matter was ripe for summary judgment when it was filed. Plaintiff had an opportunity to ask the court to continue the motion and proceed with expert discovery. That didn't happen. He took the opportunity to file a 191A affidavit, put his expert's opinions before the court without subjecting it to cross-examination. And unfortunately, that expert wasn't qualified, and the opinions aren't substantiated by the facts in the record. I want to talk a little bit, unless anyone else has any other questions, about the Marshall case that plaintiff brought up. And we did initially touch on this idea of the magnitude of the burden placed on defendant and the consequences of placing the burden of certain duties on the defendant. That came up pretty early on in plaintiff's argument. So I do just want to circle back to it. Marshall does not apply in this particular situation. The four factors that are discussed in Marshall relate to the reasonable foreseeability of injury and the likelihood of injury. Both of those in this particular case can be lumped together because, as we discussed previously, this furnace, that particular combustion system, the gas used at the onset of the chemical reaction, is not going to produce enough carbon monoxide to be hazardous to human health. It can be left untuned indefinitely without creating a risk of injury. More importantly, the two other factors, the magnitude of placing the burden on defendant and the consequences of placing the burden on the defendant, I think speak quite loudly. In this particular instance, this furnace was owned, operated, maintained, and repaired by PTC or a third party that PTC hired. PS Energy was on site maybe 2 days per year for one day working on a very specialized portion of the furnace. Placing the burden on PS Energy to ensure good air quality in the facility, to ensure that the furnace is adequately repaired, or that even the combustion system is repaired, would be quite high of a magnitude and would be much of a burden on PS Energy.
But counsel, didn't they voluntarily undertake that burden when they showed up pursuant to the phone call that was made in January with regard to this unusual, if not an emergency, situation?
That is an excellent question. The evidence is a bit vague on one, what communication was had between PTC and PS Energy during this alleged phone call. That's never been fleshed out. That's not in testimony. Brian Stallard, I believe, testified that any communication between PTC and PSN would have been with one of the owners, not with him. He testified that his understanding of what was going on was given to him by one of his bosses at PSN. So this isn't coming directly from PTC. There's not an established agreement between PTC and Brian Stallard about what he was expected to do while he was there. More importantly, there's no evidence about what was communicated or what was agreed to. There is nothing in the record that plaintiff can point to say PTC contacted PS Energy to investigate elevated levels of carbon monoxide in their facility. It was Brian Stallard's understanding that he was there to ensure that the combustion system was working appropriately and then to conduct their typical tuning. When he arrived, part of voluntary undertaking is that it applies limited to what was actually affirmatively undertaken and is construed very narrowly. Without more evidence of what, if anything, he was expected to do or had agreed to do, plaintiff can't meet his burden. What we do know, based on the purchase order, is that it was agreed that they would perform their typical combustion tuning services, and he did so. As I mentioned, it was his understanding that he was to check on the if the combustion system was the source of any elevated levels of carbon monoxide. There is no evidence that he didn't, or he failed in that duty. He found nothing wrong with it. It was a system that was, according to Wyant, who looked at the data, in good condition. I would disagree that there was any voluntary undertaking related to that January phone call.
Except we've got these various, I mean, we know that they wore the CO monitors when they came, and they also took readings each of the times that they were there during that time in January. So why wouldn't that suggest that their undertaking was to look at, even if they were doing a tuning at the time, look at the issue of the carbon monoxide?
So the carbon monoxide, interestingly enough, is that data that they take with their probes, in addition to the gas and air pressure, that helps inform them if tuning is being done correctly. So it's meant to be a data point for the purpose of tuning. It's not meant to be a safety situation or for them to ensure that the combustion system is not exhausting elevated levels of carbon monoxide. The use of their carbon monoxide detectors is for personal protection. That is so that they know when they're walking into an industrial plant like that, that they are not being exposed to elevated levels of carbon monoxide. In addition to that, a big part of voluntary undertaking is also the increased risk to the plaintiff and then a reliance. In this particular instance, the other element to this is that there's no evidence that PTC opted to forego any sort of carbon monoxide investigation or hired any other entity to help alleviate this alleged elevated levels of carbon monoxide. There's absolutely no evidence that there was a reliance by PTC on PSN in order to effectuate this.
Council,
Sure.
I don't know if you can hear me. My
I can't.
microphone's been a little wonky today. So, if they're undertaking, well, they're measuring CO for their own protection, but the CO levels are so critical to everyone's safety, and they're if they find elevated or a risky level that may affect the employees in the plant, do they not have an obligation then at that point, or a duty to do something about that, or to inform the people in the plant that their safety may be at risk?
I would say generally, yes. I don't think that that's what we're dealing with here, though, because there are no facts that they discovered any elevated levels of carbon monoxide. Their carbon monoxide monitors that they use for their own personal safety never went off. I think you've proposed a good hypothetical, but I think it's just I imagine they would have a duty. I don't think it's applicable here based on the facts.
And just to follow up on that, is there any evidence in this case at all that there was CO being emitted from the machinery that PSN was examining was leaking any CO into the plant?
So, I imagine there's a distinction between exhausting and leaking. I don't know that there was any evidence that there was any carbon monoxide leaking from the inner workings of the tubes that are inside of the furnace. However, that chemical reaction has to go somewhere after it's completed. So, there are 28 exhaust stacks. So, there would have been some amount of carbon monoxide. The readings that were taken, the final readings that are taken after tuning, that occurs at the very end of the chemical reaction before it enters the elbow-shaped exhaust stack, goes up, hits the dilution period where general atmosphere is added, and then is ultimately exhausted into the general atmosphere 10 feet up. So yes, the combustion system produces carbon monoxide. I don't think we've ever denied that, but if your question is whether it was leaking from somewhere other than where it was supposed to be normally and anticipatorily exhausted, I think the answer is no. And then I do just want to very briefly, in my last 2 minutes, unless anyone has any other questions, discuss this conflation of duty and breach the plaintiff brought up. I think it's pretty apparent from the court's order, the analysis that she used, and I understand this is a de novo review, but I agree that it's the appropriate analysis, and I would kindly ask this honorable panel to take it into consideration. You can't talk about breach without duty. An act or omission is not a breach unless there was a duty to act or refrain. So in this particular instance, the court, as a question of law, made a determination about the scope and range of PS Energy's duty that was firmly within her purview. She established it in the court order to perform combustion tuning services. From there, because this is a summary judgment motion, she had to look at what, if any, evidence was offered by plaintiff to establish that that duty was not met or that duty was somehow breached. Appropriately, she decided, or it was made obvious, plaintiff had proffered no evidence related to that specific duty. Plaintiff's entire focus had been on the duty he was attempting to assert. The purpose of summary judgment is for judicial efficiency. Things that would normally be under the purview of the trier of fact can be appropriately decided by the trial court if there's no evidence that the plaintiff will ever recover. In this particular instance, because plaintiff offered no disputed evidence, no contradictory evidence, the trial court was left with the only decision, which is to find that there was not a breach because plaintiff had proffered no evidence that there was. In my last 10 seconds, I do just want to thank you all for your time. And that's all I got.
Thank you.
Mr. Nolan?
Thank you, panel. I've got a couple of issues I'd like to speak about Appellee's argument. My co-counsel or my colleague here has stated accurately that the 500 ppm industry standard put forth by PSN relates to the conclusion of tuning, and I think that's important to note here because when the tuning is done properly, it would take whatever ppm was being exhausted down from whatever that number is to below 500 ppm. And ultimately, if this tuning was done timely, the four areas that were exhausting levels higher than 500 ppm would have been tuned and brought down below that threshold in a timely fashion to have avoided the plaintiff's January 26 poisoning. Now, there was talk about the fact that the January 26 poisoning didn't render any COHB levels, but the plaintiff also put forth an affidavit from his PM&R expert, who's also a carbon monoxide inhalation expert, who did opine that the plaintiff was poisoned on January 26 by carbon monoxide, and that affidavit was not stricken by the court. And the court has also taken judicial notice of the dangers of CO levels. Now, there were questions asked by one of your honors regarding whether or not there was any leaking outside of the exhaust stack. And if we look specifically at the January 27th work order, this is taken directly from it. Quote, four of the 28 tubes had high initial CO readings, and zone three was smoking at low fire. This would have contributed only slightly to the CO plant issue. So we have here direct evidence that zone three of these burners was smoking at low fire, and that Mr. Stallard, who authored this report, does admit that the high initial CO readings were contributing to the CO plant issue. And now there's been also discussion about the genesis of this call from PTC to address the carbon monoxide issues. And there is testimony from Mr. Stallard on page 95 of his deposition question. So PTC first reached out about this carbon monoxide issue on January 3rd, 2018. True? Answer, yes. Question, and whether it was labeled as an emergency for one reason or the other, PS Energy didn't get out there until January 26, 2018. True? Answer, yes. That has been addressed in appellant's brief and also been addressed in appellee's brief, where they say on rehabilitation he changed his testimony. But ultimately, that is a question of fact for the jury to weigh for that witness. He affirmatively testified yes to both of those questions plaintiff posed, that there was a communication beginning as early as January 3rd about carbon monoxide issues, and that ultimately PSN didn't arrive until January 26th. And again, even if we put that all aside about the CO issue, 6 months prior to, or I'm sorry, 6 months after the previous tuning would have been January 13th, 2018, which is again, would have been earlier than the January 26th poisoning. So to wrap up here, the trial court's order striking the 191 affidavit of Green and granting summary judgment was ultimately, in plaintiff's position, made an error. And the trial court effectively inserted itself as a juror in disqualifying Green without any cross-examination, voir dire, and striking the entire affidavit instead of only those parts it deemed not to meet the reasonably competent to testify 191A witness standard. Then the court conflated the issue of duty and breach in determining that PSN had no duty and that no industry standards were breached, despite clear evidence that the 500 ppm standard was exceeded up to max, which is over 18 times the industry ppm in the that's made of evident in the work orders. And then the court ruled that there was no proximate cause, despite the Farrell and the Donaldson rulings, which tell us that PSN need only be a contributing cause without any quantification in order to create a viable claim. And again, we have that contributing clause evidence directly from the work order. So the plaintiff, in sum, would respectfully request that this honorable court reverse the trial court's granting of PSN's motion to strike the 191A affidavit and the PSN's motion for summary judgment and remand the case for trial. I thank each of the your honors on the panel for their time and consideration of this appeal. And unless there are any other questions, I see that my time is up.
Thank you. Justice Vancell, do you have any further questions?
I don't.
Justice Grischow?
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The court will take the matter under advisement and render a decision in due course.